Have you ever farted cold?
I can't say I've ever noticed myself farting cold.
I have definitely farted, like, body temperature, but I don't know that I've ever gone below body temperature.
Yeah, so here's a phenomenon that I want to discuss today. Sorry, listeners, by the way, we'll be talking about farts. It's the one subject that I always get weird about.
Yeah.
I'll talk about cum and poo all day long. For
all
some
day.
Reason...
Farts are where you draw your line,
something about farts seems a bit beneath me. However, I need to talk about the phenomenon of farting cold. It happened the other day. Now, when I say cold, it wasn't chilled.
Okay, so it wasn't like you'd shoved an ice cube up your ass and then farted around.
No,
it.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't even like I'd pulled a quiche out the fridge and shoved it up there. But a breeze came out. That's the point. Like,
okay.
Like,
ever so slightly below body temperature.
I let off a fluff, a demure, dignified fluff. Out it goes, right? And I'm like, oh,
right.
That's refreshing. I imagine, like, oh, I tell you what it was, and it's funny because we talked about this on Boston's Favorite Son last time. Those eye test machines at the opticians where they blow
the puff on the eyeball.
Yeah, I did an eyeball puff out of my ass. That's what I did.
Huh.
I did an eye test fart. Maybe that's what those machines are. Maybe they've got a very small person. Maybe a 2 foot tall man is in there with his, and I'm imagining him dressed as a gnome, obviously. They've got a gnome in that machine, and the funnel, like there's a funnel that like encapsulates his anus. And then they get you to look in the, and it doesn't test jack shit. What the fuck do they think they're going to find blowing air in your eyes? Everyone knows that the Specsavers is just tricking people to get farted in their face by gnomes.
Steph, I'm amazed that within 2 minutes we made it to the words eyeball fart, because I wanted to start the show today by talking about my favourite ghost I've learned about from Japan, which is weirdly eyeballs and butts adjacent.
Is it the shit-eating ghosts? The hungry ghosts?
No.
Oh, because I love those.
This is a ghost called the Shirime. It is a mischievous ghost that appears at first glance to just be a regular human. They are naked. And they mean you no harm, but their whole deal is that they will, like, run up to you, turn around, and, like, put their, like, turn so their butt is facing you and pull their cheeks apart. Only for you to see that they have an eyeball where their anus should be.
I came up with a movie starring Willem Dafoe called Blue Eye in the Brown Eye. It was mostly a word-for-word remake of Devil's Advocate, except instead of Al Pacino being the devil, Willem Dafoe's eyeball was in Brendan Fraser's ass, and it could predict
Little
the future.
Little did you know you were treading on the realms of Japanese folklore.
Listeners, send in your answers on a stamped addressed envelope to our Maidstone studio offices, which is where the ITV studios were. Send in if you've ever had an eye test fart, an optician's trump, as we in the business call it. Because on 40 years on this earth, it's the first time I farted cool, I guess you would say. It came out with enough of a breeze that I think it could have pushed one of those little paper boats. I reckon it could have gotten at least a foot across a lake. Obviously the real wind would assist, but I reckon my eye test fart would give it that little bit of imp it needs to at least add 2 inches to that travel distance.
You've really opened my eyes today.
Wow.
Not so open that an eye test fart's gonna get in there, but
I have a theory, and this is where people might be able to confirm this, because people have colonics all the time. But basically, I've talked before about certain medications I'm on at times that make me shit my guts out. My theory is my entire cavity was so empty, there was no shit for the fart to get caught on the way out. It came out unimpeded, so it could breeze out. And because there was no like hot, stinky shit for it to cling to, it came out cold and it came out clean. If anyone has ever had like a colonic or has shit their guts out, you know, maybe if you're listening, like, take a load of laxatives. Don't bother reading maximum dosage on the packet. Just swallow it all and let us know what the results are next week. Whether you fart cool.
Welcome to Podquisition. We talk about video games here sometimes when we're not talking about cold farts.
I feel like I've died. I just stopped. Yeah. I finished my last sentence and just once it was all out, I just felt dead.
You'd put out into the world everything you had. All that you had in you to express was the farts.
It's literally all I had today. That's all I've come today. Was the two instances, actually. It was two instances within a very short amount of time. I'm talking about it again. Ooh. It's all I've got. It's all I have these days. This is what I do. I catalogue my farts alone in my stinking cot.
Well, I catalogue video games I've played sometimes. Have either of you played any of them this week, or is it just
God,
me?
No.
Some video games to the video game show and tell.
I fucking played Dragon's Dogma 2. It's shit. Moving on. What did the rest of you play?
I'll jump in with one.
Yeah,
why
go
not?
For it.
I played through, in one day, I played through the whole game. I played through Princess Peach Showtime.
Oh, I played a bit of that.
Yeah, so this is that new Princess Peach video game on the Switch. Mm-hmm. This is only her second time ever having a video game. The first time, her superpower was crying because she's a girl, and now it's do dress up and have ribbons.
I bought that one last year. I think we talked about it on Podquisition, because she has different emotions that is a gameplay mechanic.
It's distraught, angry, giggly, and emotionless are the four girl emotions.
Women have feelings, dumb broads.
Women have feelings. Now they have ribbons and clothing.
Dickheads.
So, Princess Peach Showtime. I don't think it's a bad game, but it's a game that, like, I have a weird set of caveats around.
Mm.
First of all, I don't think that game does itself any favours with its first two levels. I think its first two levels, the ones in the demo, are the least interesting ones in that game. They are not particularly great as a way to set the game up.
They're very dry. That's how I describe quite a bit of the game, which I also agree is quite good, but a lot of it, I'm just playing it and I'm like, this is very down. It downplays itself.
Its problem is its structure, I think. So having completed it, the gist of the game is Peach goes to see a play at a theatre, and evil spooky witch happens, and now the plays are evil, or whatever. And each of the stages you go into in the game is, like, theoretically meant to be a stage play you're acting on. Now, first of all, Nintendo has done games where, like, the gimmick is you are on a stage doing a performance before, and this feels like one of the least well-utilized ones of those. If you look at something like Paper Mario The Thousand Year Door, you constantly, in battles, were on a stage, and you had, like, an audience of little, like, Goombas and Koopas and whatever. In silhouette, you could see them sort of watching the thing play out on the stage. They'd occasionally interact with you in combat. There's none of that here. The fact that you're in a play really only affects the fact that the background looks like it's props. But the way that the game is structured doesn't do itself any favours, because the game has 10 transformations that are like an outfit you get, and that changes the gameplay. Each of those outfits follows a very, 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 very similar structure on how it's used. Each of them is used for 3 levels, maybe 2.5 levels. The first level, half of the first level, you don't have your new transformation that makes that level unique, because they want you to explore the area not having the power so that you have a contrast and you see what the power now is. There is a second level where you actually do a level that, like, lets you get straight into it and explore that mechanic. And then there is a third level for that outfit where it's like, cool, here's the rest of our ideas. That outfit's gone in the bin now. It's never to be explored again.
Yeah.
The problem with that formula is that it creates a game that feels like it is walking in between two different design approaches, which either one of them I think would have been better. On the one end, you have something like Super Mario Wonder from last year, where you have a game that every single level had a completely wacky original new idea that they knew they were only going to explore for like 45 seconds, so they threw every idea they had for that mechanic in one go. Don't get too attached, we're moving on, something new, something original. And on the other side, you have games that, like, have fewer transformations and fewer mechanics, but explore them in more depth. This sits weirdly in the middle. It's not throwing enough new ideas at you regularly enough to feel like it's constantly new, but it's not sticking with any one idea long enough to truly get into the nuances of the potential of that mechanic, and it sticks around just long enough for you to start seeing the potential of a transformation before throwing it in the bin to go, you're never using that again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not every transformation in the game is a winner, but when you find one that feels really good, because you understand the formula that has been established, you go, I can't get too attached to this gameplay style because it's going to be gone soon. As a result, I kind of walked away from this game going, there are moments I really enjoyed it, but I was constantly feeling like I would love like a whole game or a whole section of worlds based around this idea, and I know this is the last time I'm going to see it.
Yeah. I basically agree with you, 100%. I've not played it as much as you. I got onto the second tier of levels and done a bit of that. I don't think I disagree with anything you've said. I'd like to add that I think what you said about not feeling too attached to the different costumes and stuff, I feel like that attitude is shared by the game itself.
I agree.
I immediately noticed it in the demo as well, when I got the cowgirl like outfit and that. You don't do a lot with it. Like, you have this, it's a whip, isn't it? Yeah, a whip.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it
yeah.
does one or two very select things. And it's just almost a variant of what she was already doing. Like,
yeah, because she already had her ribbon that was basically a whip.
Yeah, and especially with a Nintendo and a Mario like related game in particular, I think we're so used to seeing them take ideas that are often simple but so versatile. And that's something this game seems to lack is the versatility, because I think possibly like it has that attitude that you were right to say the player has. Why would they make a very like a deeper, more complex version of that cowboy suit when it's going to be in the bin within three levels? I kind of understand why a lot of it feels a bit half-baked. Not that I am justifying that. I think that's definitely the case, though. Like, they haven't really fleshed anything out because the game itself doesn't have a lot of a skeleton to put that flesh on.
And the problem is, the moments where I was enjoying the game the most were the ones where that contrast was the most stark. Because, like, there's a few of the transformations a bit further in that I think are genuinely interesting and I would have loved to have seen explored more. One of my favourites is there's a ninja outfit, and you have this, like, children's approachable sort of Mark of the Ninja-style stealth combat thing where you are essentially, like, I think what works really well about it is the game is very clear about when you're in cover. If you're, like, crouching in grass, Peach holds up a little fake cardboard bush to hide behind. And you know if you're behind the little cardboard bush, you're invisible. And, like, the enemies that are looking for you have, like, very visible vision cones.
I love the effect of the other effect she has when she's up against a wall and then puts...
All the invisibility scroll thing she hides behind.
Yeah, basically puts like a curtain in front of her and then that takes on the shape. A bit like the Octo Camo in Metal Gear Solid 4, except it's more of a one-to-one effect. Like whatever's behind her is represented on the cloth. And it's just a really cool little effect. It looks really nice.
And they're all really good effects that like make it very clear what your state in the world is.
Yeah.
And there is a good degree of, like, forgiveness in terms of, like, being able to pop out of stealth, do your little dash attack, get back into stealth with a degree of forgiveness. Like, they've made a genuinely engaging, child-approachable stealth action game. Like, I would love to see a Princess Peach stealth action game that really explored these mechanics with that mentality of making it very approachable to know when you are correctly in stealth. There is a section later on that has a figure skating transformation, and they do some really interesting stuff with combining figure skating as a scored competitive sport with a combat system. And that's really interesting.
Yeah.
And the problem is these ideas are interesting, and then they just put them in the bin.
Yeah.
At the very least, and I don't feel like this is too spoilery to say, I expected the final level of this game to be a big gauntlet where all of the transformations came back one after another and you had like a big all of them in one thing. No, there is never more than one transformation in a stage. When you're done with them, you're done with them. And I've been thinking about what feels weird about this. I think, narratively, they try and bake in an excuse as to why she doesn't come back to them. These were never meant to be her transformations. Each transformation's third level is you going and rescuing the person who was meant to be that character in the play. And once they're rescued, you don't get to be that character in the play anymore. You've rescued the person whose job that actually is. And it really feels like your reward for doing the three levels for an outfit is, okay, you don't get to be that in the play anymore. You saved the person whose job that is. You were just stepping in. You're the understudy. Go back to being Peach. It gives the game such a weird sense of Peach does not have ownership over any of the mechanics or designs that she gets to play with, but they're never truly hers. And that is a very weird sentiment for a game like this, because I imagine the target audience for this is young girls. What I would imagine you would want for that audience is, by the end of it, let Peach go into any level dressed as any one of these outfits, because this is now your set of outfits for your little virtual doll. And, like, taking away your virtual outfits feels so weird.
Yeah. And, I mean, speaking as a young girl myself, I was very excited about this game. I've always liked the idea of Peach as the star of a game.
Agreed.
I'm not sure what it is, but I always loved the idea of that DS one, even with the emotions bit being a bit squiffy.
As someone that lovingly owned a copy of Barbie Game Girl for the Game Boy that I played for many, many hundreds of hours, despite it being a terrible game, I can empathize. I've wanted a good Princess Peach game
like,
for a while.
And I was thrilled about the dress-up bit. Like, you know, not to be true to type, but I've talked many times, I love cosmetics, and one of my favourite elements of this game is that you can buy new patterns for Peach's, like, default original dress. There's a gorgeous pink-to-white gradient you can get. It's delicious.
That said, can I talk about the thing that annoys me most about that fucking dress?
You may!
Someone at Nintendo decided that Peach's default walking and running animation in this game would be her having to hold up dress with one hand.
Yeah.
That is the entire game. She has to run around holding her dress up by one hand. They couldn't just go, look, let the dress touch the floor, we'll just, like, have the fantasy that she's not, you know, tripping over her own dress, or mildly, you know, tweak the dress design so that, like, she doesn't, you know, it's clear that she's got room to step and not step on it. Who designs a game where your hero spends the entire game with one of their hands not able to be used? Like, your protagonist is constantly playing one-handed because she's got to hold a fucking dress up.
If they'd made an actual point of that, I'd love it. If there was an actual point to how badass she was, that she's holding up her dress and manages to keep it pristine while doing all this, but the game doesn't follow through on that. That's the problem.
Or even if there was something about, like, how it would be unprincess-like to not do it, right? To draw some attention to that fact in a flagrant manner would go a long way.
But the thing that annoys me about it is you can go look at other Nintendo games. She doesn't do this in other Nintendo games. She doesn't need to run holding her dress up in Smash Brothers.
Pretty sure that they thought it was cute. And it, in a way, it is. But I thought the same thing when I saw her lift it. I was like, oh, come on.
It would have been a fucking cliche, but it would have been so easy to, like, have your dainty feminine hero do the thing that happens in so many movies where it's like, cool, I've got to be the hero, like, Mario's not around. I'll slightly, like, rip off a bit of the bottom of my dress and take my heels
Who
off.
Who doesn't
I'm gonna
love
go
that?
Be the hero.
Who doesn't love the old, like, ripped dress?
It's a cliche, but it's a really, it's a good cliche.
But honestly, like, if there was an actual point to it. That's the only difference, is it having a point and it just existing. As it just exists, it sends, potentially, a shitty message. If they'd have just done something with it. Like, especially when you mention one-handed.
Yeah.
There's a show that I haven't watched it in years and I'm well due a rewatch, Trailer Park Boys. Where one of the main characters, he always has that drink in his hand. Always. No matter what he's doing, no matter what the context, one hand always has that drink, and it's a character detail that I fucking love, and it's a character detail I'd have loved in this if they'd have done anything other than, haha, she's lifting her skirt. You know, I can do that if you get enough drinks in me and Leeds. Like, no one's making a game about it. Fucking THQ Nordic said no.
I want to be clear, though. I do like this game.
Mm-hmm. It's cute.
I complain about it because I feel like it could have been more. Like, I feel like there is so much potential that isn't utilized. But when it's in its stride, it's really fun. And I agree. I like that there's the little cosmetic shop where you can buy all the new dresses and all the new outfits for your little star friend. I like that you can... I don't know if you know that you can do this, Steph. You can slide down the banisters if you're going from a higher floor to a lower floor.
Oh, I've not done that yet. That's cute.
There's a lot of really cute stuff that this does, while I think it could have been more.
Yeah.
My other problem with it, I wanted to go through and, like, obsessively collect every hidden star in all the levels. But the game's design is really not built to make that enjoyable to do.
Yes, I was going to make a point with the detective levels. I don't want to do them twice.
Yeah, well, I don't want to do any of the levels twice. And it's not because the levels themselves aren't good. But the problem is, there is no mechanic to quickly go back through a level. Every text box you can't button mash through to make the text go faster. You can't skip through cutscenes you've already seen before. Most of the levels have, like, 5 or 6, like, hard cut-off you can't go back once you've gone this far points. And if you realise you've missed a star, you can't backtrack. You have to redo the whole level, every slow cutscene, every slow conversation, every slow panning shot, to try and find that star you missed. And if you miss it again, got to restart the whole thing again.
That's not really acceptable.
It is not built in a way that makes it fun to kind of rush back through a level to roughly where you think a thing you missed might be.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I mentioned the detective levels because they're the slowest and most dialogue-heavy, and it's all they are is like looking at objects and being talked to. And I know I don't want to do that twice, but you're right as well. Like, I think about some of the more fun levels, and I wouldn't find it edifying to play that again. I'd play more of that, but I mean, I'm not even excited about playing, like, the content in it that I've not played. And again, it's not that it's bad. It's a good game.
I think it's worth sticking with. The content gets better.
I'm going to stick with
further
it.
Further in. I think it does itself a real disservice. Its earliest levels are its worst.
Yeah. The issue I have is I've got Dragon's Dogma 2, which is shit.
Yeah.
But, you know, got a review on the go. I've got that Rise of Ronin, which I'm sure we'll be talking about. I had Final Fantasy VII, of course, and with all of that, like, every time I think about picking up Princess Peach, I'm like, eh, you know? I'll get to it once I've cleared some of the stuff I'm playing off my docket, but it's not been exciting enough that it's made me want to stop any of the other stuff I'm doing for it. Unlike Rise of Ronin.
Yeah, do you want to talk about Rise of Ronin?
I fucking hate Dragon's Dogma. It is it is so hard, like, going back to Dragon's Dogma 2 after any extended amount of time. After 5 minutes of playing Rise of Ronin, which has fast travel and doesn't drain your stamina when you're out of combat. So you can run in the big open world. Not that you have to do that all the time, because you get a horse and a glider. And that's just travel. And then, of course, there's, you know, you get the fast travel and quest objectives are clear. You have clear directions of... You don't have to guess what the developer was thinking while going tee-hee. Oh my god, I saw some crafting materials while playing Rise of Ronin today and hesitated for a moment to pick them up because I didn't want my carrying capacity to go from average to heavy. And then I realised, that's not in Rise of Ronin! I can pick up a flower and not become too heavy! I laughed. It's a good game. I'm excited.
I'm having fun with Rise of Ronin.
It's one of them games that while I play it, I'm excited to see what's next. It's drowning me in loot, almost overwhelmingly, but just on that cusp. So much loot, so much sense of reward. The combat is... I mean, it's this interesting sort of meeting point between Sekiro and Ghost of Tsushima and... a Neo as well, especially when it comes to loot. It's got all these elements, and it's not as singularly good as any one of them, but with all its elements together, I think it stands just as tall as any of those games.
It doesn't feel nearly as bad as a pastiche of as many things as it is should feel. Because, like, anytime I try and describe Rise of Ronin, all I want to do is describe it in relation to other things it kind of sort of feels like.
Yeah.
And that's usually a recipe for a pretty terrible game. Like, I come into this going, like, it reminds me in places of old Assassin's Creed games. It reminds me in places of Sekiro. It reminds me in places of, like, Nioh or Ghost of Tsushima. It's such a melting pot of different inspirations.
I'll tell you what that reminds me of. Now, I don't think this does it quite as well, but it reminds me of Singularity, which is a game I love bringing up. An old Raven Software game that I often described as a best of FPS mixtape, where they just took a lot of sort of contemporary FPSs at the time. You had like Half-Life and Bioshock and all of that stuff. They took gimmicks and ideas and mechanics from all of them, and it really was a mixtape, a compilation of the best of all these elements. And it was great. This isn't quite a best of, but it's a quality clip show.
Yeah.
I enjoy it very much for that.
Yes.
My only major complaint so far is the thing I was most excited about, because you and I were talking about this last week.
Yeah.
I was very much looking forward to the co-op. That was a big selling point for me. And I'm not sure how you found it, but I love it when I can get in. It's just another game, another fucking game that's having really shit matchmaking.
So this was my big thing I was excited about, is I was enjoying playing the first, you know, opening hours of the single player, and didn't really have anyone during the review period to be able to get into the co-op with, so I was like, okay, I'll just wait until it comes out. I've got other stuff, work stuff on my plate. I'll play it when it's out and see how the co-op is, and again, I agree, it's great when I can connect to people. Mm-hmm. Because, like, I love fundamentally the idea of what they're trying to do co-op-wise here, and I like that they are trying to build that into, even if you're playing in single player, that mentality is there. I like the idea of you collecting together your little NPCs who'll occasionally come on your little missions with you, and they basically act as like a whole second set of weapons and tools you have available to you, you can swap control of during the middle of a mission. Moving a little away from the idea of like a Souls-type game has to be about you being alone and lonely and no one can back you up. I like those thematic elements. I wish I could play online with other people really easily.
Yeah. Because when I heard it was co-op focused, having played Lords of the Fallen and considering that the benchmark for if you want co-op in a Souls-like, Lords of the Fallen is the first truly like co-op centered Souls-like. And it's
you can
great.
See what I was hoping it would be.
Yes. And it's not.
Having not had a chance to try it, but seeing, like, the narrative setting up the importance of co-op and knowing there was co-op in there.
Yeah.
It seemed like there was a really obvious way co-op would work in this, and that's not how it works.
And it is a shame, because I love exploring the open world in this one. There's something about Sony open worlds that they're very structurally similar to Ubisoft open worlds. But there's something so breezy about them that I don't find them dull, and I will do the open world busy work stuff, because moving through the world's a treat. I can't even quite vocalise the main difference between them.
I think for me, part of it is there are parts of the world that don't feel obviously like they're there for an objective, that you can just sort of go through a bit of those worlds that, to me, feels like it's just there to be a part of the world.
Yeah, I think
that is something I sometimes struggle to find in Ubisoft ones.
Yeah, Ubisoft games are very sort of, look, we know we're a video game. You know we're a video game. We're not going to pretend we're anything else. Whereas, you know, there is a bit more, not to use the overused word, but there is a bit more of an immersive feel to sort of some of the Sony open worlds. But all of this is to say that I do wish that had more online elements. So far, it's almost like something like, say, to bring up another Ubisoft game, The Division, where the open world stuff is its own thing, and then you go on these missions that are almost like raids. And even then, like the co-op in Rise of Ronin is reduced from The Division, because there's not a lot of chance encounters with other players in the open world. You can see different samurai and stuff with like player names above their heads, and I think they're supposed like they're NPC controlled versions of other players. The ease with which I killed one earlier suggests it wasn't a human, although it did have the same funny cartoon mask that I had on. By the way, this game has lots of dress up options, does that fun thing where you can make armor look like any other bit of armor, all of that shit. You can look very silly or very cool in the game, all about it. But yeah, I wish the online was a bit more like Lords of the Fallen, where it wasn't like the Souls games, where it's so temporary. and there's no real versatility to it. It's you will stay with this player till this mission is done and this boss is dead and then unceremoniously gone.
Yeah. And again, the game is so built around the idea of fighting alongside someone else that you've built up a real bond with.
Yeah, it's puzzling.
It was so suited for it.
It is strange that they decided to not do more. Although, given how it's struggling to do what it already does, maybe it's for the best. Because it really does end up feeling like a game of two halves. There's the kind of standard open world experience that you can get and is, you know, cathartic enough. Travel the world, pet cats, take down fugitives, which I enjoy very much. I like all the different fugitive bosses strewn about the map. I love all the stuff with like building bonds with characters and the many ways in which the game rewards you with stuff. The skill system is one of the more interesting ones I've seen, with generic skill points and then stat-specific skill points that are earned in different ways. And yeah, it's just a shame that the multiplayer and that experience feel so separate. They're not really melded together at all. Makes me think of a more old game where multiplayer was always presented as a very separate element to the real game. And that's what this feels like. And like you say, with a game focused so much on working together and building alliances and fighting alongside people, it's strange. Online multiplayer and co-op would be so divorced from the rest of it. There's a lot about it I love.
I do like that you can be a cat pimp.
We were on very different paths when we were talking about cats just then.
Yeah, sure. You go into your thing that wasn't petting cats.
You can be a cat pimp.
Yeah.
You build up a bond with the cat lady enough, or you just pick up enough cats, one of the two, and then the cat concierge service opens and people want the cats. So you rent the cats out.
Yeah.
And the way it's initially presented to the player, it makes it sound like you're a cat pimp.
It does. It does.
I enjoy the game very much. I really like the voice acting, which is very similar to Ghost of Tsushima, where it's not American people playing Japanese characters. Everyone sounds appropriate. I really like that. I really like the visual design of it, and the map is very open, and that's something that has really stood out to me after playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth and Dragon's Dogma, where so much of their open spaces are linear paths disguised to look open, and they're so fiddly, and it's often hard to get to an objective because it's like, what in this noodle soup of pathways, which is the right one that gets me where I want to go? Whereas after spending so much time playing those two games and then jumping into Rise of Ronin, where there's the whole open air that you can glide through, they've managed to make very horizontal terrain that doesn't feel boring. So it's very open, very plain, very easy to get where you're directly where you're going without getting caught working out paths and finding the one linear route that has been obscured. It's just so much more accessible, easy to get into, and a breezier experience. And we didn't even talk about the combat. Like, really interesting combat. They took the Sekiro thing with the counters and that, and then just added a whole bunch of other weird shit. It's, again, we talk about, like I mentioned, the meeting point of different games. It's got the versatility and class building and different weapons of a Dark Souls with the parrying focused stealth action of Sekiro. But where Sekiro was very restrictive, to its credit, many would say, it had one way it wanted to be played, and that's the way it was played. Rise of Ronin has the same gameplay, but that added versatility so that if you're shit at parrying, you're not going to have, the easiest time, but you're not completely fucked like you were in Sekiro. So yeah, a lot of the time for me, it's been like a Sekiro I can play, so I like that.
Yeah. What about you, Conrad? What have you been playing this week?
I have been playing a survival crafting game, and I'm like way, way late to the party on this. Have either of you played Darkwood?
No, the name's familiar.
Is Darkwood the sort of toppy, downy horror?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I've definitely not played this.
I've made several attempts and always reached a point very early in where I'm like, I'm not going to get on with this. Which is a shame, because I have a book. It's just, you know, back when I was a relevant games media person, they sent me a notebook, a Darkwood notebook, and it's a black book, and inset into it is like a branch from a tree. Mm. Like inset into, I think, not real wood, but it's just in there is this inset relief. It's gorgeous. Sorry, I'm talking.
No.
Sorry. Just completely went off the rails then. How are you finding it?
I like it. Linda, my wife, found it on the Switch, just sort of looking for horror games, and picked it up. And I was watching her play it for a bit, and she's hooked. And so I went ahead and checked it out, and I can definitely see why. It's weirdly approachable for me. The setup is you're sort of dumped into this forest, and the map is randomly generated in its sort of four regions that exist. So you can't rely on your memory of where things were if you were to replay it, and everybody's game could be a little bit different, which is neat. But you explore around this forest by day, finding landmarks and collecting resources, and by night you have to be in your hideout to protect yourself from basically instant death if you're outside the zone of your house. But then during the night, creatures and weird things will be attracted to your house, and they'll try to break in and kill you. And so you have to set up defenses by barricading doors and windows with the resources that you found. You can use the furniture in the houses. A lot of items can be pushed around, and they can function as barriers, which enemies can push through or just straight up destroy. And then all of those furniture pieces can be rebuilt, which I kind of love. There's just something charming. There's something truly charming to me about dragging the furniture around the house and trying to use it instead of the barricades and so forth. You get a pretty decent range of equipment and weapon options for defense, too. You can make bear traps and put them in front of the windows, so if your barricade fails, at least the first guy in is likely to hit the bear trap and take damage, be stunned, and give you time to beat them to death with a shovel. It's creepy. The story content is interesting. Like, there are a few plot threads centered around different characters, and they intersect at points, and it's very grim. Not great if you love dogs or pigs.
What is it with dead dogs lately? Between Dragon's Dogma and Rise of Ronin, I've had to murder so many dogs, and then you've been killing dogs all day in a game. Obviously, we don't talk about what we've been doing down by the river, but in games, you know, we've killed a lot of dogs between us this week.
It has been a lot of dogs. Yeah, no.
It's horrible.
There is a barn location that is necessary to go through to progress, I'm pretty sure. And it's just dogs. So many dogs. And the thing is, most of the dogs aren't like up and about and attacking you. They're like laying on the ground twitching near death. It is bleak.
Delicious.
But yeah, it's neat. It's got an interesting and incredibly fair in-game economy. A trader shows up at your house after every night, and so you can trade for a lot of the basic goods that you might need, but it might be too risky to scavenge enough to be in a position of safety. So those are all sort of there. And you can sell basically anything that you found to him, with a few plot-related exceptions. If you manage to survive the night without being killed, the currency in this place is reputation. And you gain reputation with that trader, and you get a bonus amount of essentially cash to purchase items from him. And so there's a lot of benefits to that. There's some leveling up that is interesting. You level up by finding certain organic items and cook them at the oven stove. And by cook, we're using it not in the food preparation, but in the heroin preparation sense. The experience meter is a syringe that fills up. And once it does and you gain a level from having cooked all these items, you get to choose a bonus. And it could be something like once a day, the first time you step on something that would, you know, be a trap, it doesn't affect you. Temporary period of infinite stamina, be able to see in a full 360 degrees around you for a minute, which could be really good in combat because you are very limited by your cone of vision in this game.
Yeah.
Very limited. And the combat isn't actually difficult. I don't find it to be challenging. What's challenging is in a situation where you might have multiple enemies, making sure that they're all within your field of vision and you know what they're doing. That's the tricky bit. In terms of the combat, it's basically just wait for attack, follow up attack. It's got a cool little like backstep dodge that I like. I do accidentally trigger it far more often than I would like to because it's tied to a thumbstick. So sometimes I'm just gripping the controller too hard because I'm about to make an attack. And instead of making an attack, I do my backstep. But I like the way the combat works in that it's not that complicated. It's just made challenging by the presence of multiple enemies. In a one-on-one situation, I haven't encountered anything that I have to fight that I can't just circle strafe and deal with. But leveling up comes with a benefit and a flaw, which might be that you take more damage from poison or something like that. And you'll get to choose from a couple of those. And I think it's every other level that you get, you have to take a flaw. It's well balanced. It's interesting. It's not that punishing of failure. When you die on the normal difficulty setting, you drop half of the stuff that you were carrying and it's left as a backpack where you died. And even shows on the map where that location was, which is rare. There isn't a lot of context-related map possibilities. You do get an ability to tear off a piece of your body and leave it somewhere once a day to show you exactly where on the map you were when you dropped it. Because the way the map works, it doesn't show you where you are. It shows you what landmark that you have previously been to you are closest to. And you have to use landmarks to figure out where you are, which, again, I kind of like. I've certainly dealt with more frustrating and annoying limited map information systems. This one's kind of fun. On the whole, I find it pretty engrossing, and I'm in the last third of the game, I think, and I've really been enjoying it. It is creepy, and I'm curious to know how some of the choices that I've made have played out, and yeah, it's Darkwood's good. I do recommend people check it out if you want a horror survival game that, you know, with good preparation is very, very achievable. So yeah, that's it.
Neat. Anyone else played anything else this week?
Yes.
That they want to talk about?
No.
The only other thing I've played this week, and I don't have a huge amount to say about it other than to reiterate praise that many months ago you were giving, Steph, I'm deep down the Theatre Rhythm Final Bar Line rabbit hole.
Oh, delicious.
Mm. That's a damn good music rhythm game / RPG, huh?
Lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, like we talked about this before. Quick summary if this is your first time hearing about it. This is a Final Fantasy music rhythm game that is also kind of an RPG. Your inputs are very, very simple. You are either pressing any button on your controller in time with like a single button input, you are holding a button down, you are moving a stick in a direction, or you are moving a stick in a direction at the end of a button hold. Those are basically your main inputs. Occasionally you'll have like a line that goes up and down a bit and you've got to hold a button down. It's not like Trombone Champ where you're trying to match an exact position as a line's going up and down. You're just trying to go, the line's going up, I'll press up on the stick. The line's going down, I'll press down on the stick. And those are sort of combined on top of each other. But the thing that makes it unique is that you are building up characters with movesets and stats and levels And as such, it is possible to 100% a level, but not beat the final boss of the level, because you did everything perfect in the music rhythm section, but you didn't have a party of characters that was doing the damage output or the right types of attacks or whatever, and you gotta fuck around with your RPG stuff while you play through the narratives of Final Fantasy games. It's fucking addictive. It's real fucking addictive, innit?
It is one of the most compelling games I've ever played. That game got me through a lot. Like, it was last year, and this time last year was shit. And that game was, like, something that helped, like, get me through that, because it was such an easy game to just keep my mind focused and keep me, like, on it.
It's a real special game. For a lot of music rhythm games, I like that it is, like, so simple in the number of inputs you're having to think about. I like that the tracks are memorable enough that, like, even if you don't know a particular Final Fantasy particularly well, you'll probably hear tracks and go, I've heard this somewhere. They're all fairly short tracks, which makes it very easy to, oh, just one more go, things. All the levels have their own sort of, like, sub-objectives to sort of keep score chasing to try and get. I like the way that you sort of go through the narratives of these games and unlock additional characters, additional narratives to go through. I think that all works really well. There's a really nice, good sense that you are progressing through narratives while all you're fundamentally doing is playing a music rhythm game. It gives it this really good sense of progression and productivity that can sometimes be lacking from a more pure music rhythm experience. It's real easy to just zone out and have a good time to. It's real special, and I finally let it get its hooks in me truly and deeply. So, yeah, that's a real special one. Should we do a couple of bits of news and then wrap up for the day?
Yeah, why not?
That sounds great.
Let's start with the one that I stumbled upon literally just before we started recording today, and I have to work out how to put my thoughts together about this one. You know Neuralink? That brain chip that Elon Musk wants to put in everyone's brains. He's put it in one person's brain. And the first thing that man did when given a brain chip that he could use to control stuff on his computer and was no longer, like, under medical supervision, was, you know, you can do what you want in your home setting. First thing he did was he used it to do an all-nighter playing Civ 6. And I'm trying to put my thoughts together because there is accessibility brain. In isolation, it is great that we live in a world where a man who was paralyzed from the neck down was able to go, I now have enough autonomy back in my life to do a Civ 6 all-nighter. That's fucking great.
Unqualified good. In a vacuum.
You put it really well when we were talking before the show, comrade, where you said something to the effect of, if this chip purely existed to allow people to do all-nighters of Civ 6, this would be a great story.
It'd be fine. Yeah, I'd have absolutely no complaints whatsoever.
But the problem we have to acknowledge is that there's a whole lot of other problems with Neuralink existing, and there's no way to separate the good that this is doing for accessibility from, do you really trust Elon Musk to put a chip in your brain and not at any point in the future either do something fucking stupid with it, or B, just abandon the project like he abandons everything he fucking works on and leaving you with a piece of tech in your brain and no plans to keep it up to date and working. Like, there's so many potential problems that I don't trust Elon Musk to be the person doing this.
No, he's proven himself to be utterly untrustworthy, and I've read enough sci-fi, and I don't need sci-fi in my life.
We don't even need the sci-fi. Like, let's look at this, like, directly. I think a really good comparison to make is a lot of people who have cochlear implants to help them be able to hear have cochlear implants that were made by companies that have since gone bankrupt. Mm-hmm. Those people are in a position where if their cochlear implant breaks in some way, the parts are no longer being produced by that for-profit company to do the repairs. The expertise no longer exists of people who know how to do those repairs. And you can end up with people who are not just, oh, my thing is broken, I've gone back to not being able to use it to hear. Sometimes they go wrong in ways where actively their life is worse because something has malfunctioned and a for-profit company is no longer doing the work to fix it. And that is a situation that already exists.
There's an even better example that you can look at for comparison, because cochlear implants fucking work.
Yeah.
Cryogenics, on the other hand. And you look at all of the companies that were storing frozen human bodies, that went out of business, that didn't maintain their facilities, and that's, I fear, what we will be looking at with Neuralink patients. Now, I could be wrong. Responsible people could step in, but the track record is not great. I mean, I'm going to pass.
Elon Musk is not a person who I would trust with making a permanent change to a person's body and committing to the serious work involved in making sure that person, as they should be treated, a medical patient, is given proper medical upkeep and treatment for the foreseeable future.
I think the thing that that amuses me about all of this Neuralink shit is that, like, the people who most typically rail about Mark of the Beast shit don't seem to have a problem with this. That's weird. Because this seems like a natural, so it almost seems like it's just happens to be that this person's doing it. For some reason, they think this charlatan, who, if I'm honest, if I were to, like, look at how the Antichrist is described, Elon's not a bad candidate.
Yeah. It is a shame, because, like, on paper, I am all fucking for finding new ways that people with disabilities can improve their access to the world. I just don't trust Elon Musk to be responsible enough to be the person heralding that.
No.
Nothing about Elon Musk leads me to believe that he will be any different to any of the people over the years who have caused problems by creating medical tech and then not properly supporting it long term.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like there's a problem with the for-profit medical industry. Like, the incentives and so forth. Hmm.
There's so many problems with them. You know a thing? This is a bit of a side topic, but this is a thing that's, like, really, really frustrates me that I've been aware of the last couple of years. If you are someone who has, like, an amputation and gets, like, a prosthetic limb, guaranteed your prosthetic limb is, like, branded with the company that made it in very large, like, difficult-to-remove text. If you purchase a prosthetic limb of some kind, you're essentially, you have to wear the fucking company logo on yourself.
Now, where they're missing a trick is in brand partnerships. Because they could hook up with a whole bunch of other companies and, like, give the user the option to get these other logos on there, and then they can split the revenue from the advertising, you know, like, have a NASCAR arm.
But it's like, you shouldn't have to think that you would get any other medical treatment done and, like, get, like, the doctor signs his name on your arm to be like, ah, fix this arm. Except we do know doctors have done that. There are doctors who have, like, scored their initials into, like, organs they've been working on.
Super cool.
Yeah, medicine for profit's kind of fucked up. But that one guy that's got the Neuralink, I hope you're enjoying pulling six all-nighters, and I hope that Musk does not, like, drop the ball and stop supporting that for you. You deserve your Civ 6 all-nighters.
Yep.
Couple of other quick stories this week. Playdate, the people making the little yellow game device with crank, they've not had a good week. $400,000 worth of Playdate consoles have disappeared in Las Vegas.
Ooh.
Yeah. The short version is there's a whole, like, little true crime thing starting to unfold. All of the Playdate systems, you have to register them online the first time you use them, and they know the serial numbers of the missing Playdate consoles, so they do have quite a lot of ability to track what's going on. But the short version is a couple of large pallets of Playdate consoles were being shipped with FedEx, and FedEx said they were delivered, but Playdate, the company, never received them. 2 weeks after that, two other pallets were delivered by FedEx to the construction site next door to Playdate, and the same person signed for them that signed for the ones that went missing. So it sure seems like maybe someone next door signed for some pallets, realised they had a bunch of game consoles, and tried to stay quiet about it. The ones that have been starting to pop up and be registered online from that stolen batch are being registered by people in Vegas, so it seems like they're, like, selling them under the table in Vegas.
Check the flea markets.
Yeah, so there's a whole, like, crime thing going on of, like, trying to track down... They think they've worked out who stole them, and they're just trying to track down, like, where are you trying to offload cheap playdates around Vegas? So, yeah, if you happen to be at, like, a weird flea market somewhere in Vegas and see someone selling hundreds of playdates, maybe let Playdate know, because, like, they're not having a great time. For a company who... their finances are not amazing. They are spending a lot of the money they have coming in. 400,000 in lost consoles is a real fucking blow for them.
Yeah, I mean, I would assume the delivery is insured. And FedEx, oh boy, that's a fuck up.
Yeah, that is a fuck up, because it seems like they've delivered to the wrong person twice, one of which was after they realized the first delivery got stolen. Like, FedEx ain't in a great spot there.
Yeah, that's going to be a problem. I mean, well, and then, you know, just, it's hard to say. Playdate inventory has, I think that they've been generally accessible now, but maybe not at the moment.
Yes, there was briefly a point where you could just order one and not have to pre-order it and it would just come. They took some to GDC and had to, you could just turn up at GDC and buy one in person. They've reached that point, but they might not be at that point right now.
Oof. Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah. And the last couple of quick stories we've got both are Xbox adjacent, because... We continue to be hearing a lot of rumblings about, like, Xbox really not being sure what they want to do with their console space at the moment. So the first one of these is Phil Spencer wants to see more digital storefronts like Epic and itch.io available on Xbox consoles.
This is very interesting to me. The timing of this is extremely interesting to me.
Yes.
Because...
yeah, do you want to speak to that?
I'd love to speak to that, because, I mean, there's a couple of things. Obviously, the company is under a lot of scrutiny at the moment, post-merger, from government regulators who might be on the lookout for antitrust violations. Mm. And at the same time as this is happening... there is a case currently moving through the courts where the federal government is accusing Apple of antitrust issues. And this all goes back again to their management of the iPhone and how it's limited in allowing software developers to interact with the phone and the payment processing system that it has.
Yes.
And the way in which it restricts developers from accessing it. And so the idea of bringing other storefronts to Microsoft products shows a willingness to not be Apple in this respect. No, we want to open our platform up. We don't want to, you know, restrict competition on our platform. Look at us.
And I would maybe go even further and suggest we know that Microsoft really fucking wants to launch their own mobile app store.
Absolutely.
And to have, like, a Microsoft store on phones. It would really be in their benefit for Apple to be seen to be being an outlier as a walled garden, and that other companies like, you know, Microsoft are willing to not be a walled garden. Maybe Apple should be forced to step into not being a walled garden too, because then maybe you get an Xbox store on iPhones, which would be a great thing for Microsoft. But yeah, speaking to Polygon, Spencer said that he wanted to break down the walled gardens and stuff. I'll read his quote. "Consider our history as a Windows company. Nobody would think twice if I said, hey, when you're using a PC, you get to decide the type of experience you want to have by picking where you buy games. There's real value in that." Now, there's a use case here that I think would be fucking hilarious, which is PlayStation has shown no interest in wanting to have their games on Xbox consoles, but they do have their games on Steam. If Steam was on Xbox... you could play your PlayStation exclusives on Xbox, in theory. And I just find that an amusing thought of Xbox Trojan horsing PlayStation exclusives onto their console.
That is pretty entertaining to consider.
I love the thought that Xbox is like, oh, you don't want to play the We Share Exclusives games? Fine, have fucking Steam. We're having your games whether you want us to or not. And the other one we've got out of Xbox this week is Phil Spencer really can't keep his mouth shut about the fact that we're probably fucking getting an Xbox handheld at the end of this year. Like, officially, he's not said that that's happening. But when he was doing his whole, we're bringing some of our Xbox games to other platforms, but don't worry, it's only a few of them. He teased there was hardware coming later this year. And then, in an interview with Polygon, he started being not at all subtle about the fact that they're clearly working on an Xbox handheld of some kind. He talked about different hardware form factors and things they could do to grow the Xbox audience further. What could we build that will find new players, that will allow play at times when they couldn't play in the past? He then goes on to, like, talk in depth about the things he likes about, like, the Steam Deck and the Lenovo Legion Go and the Asus device. He's not being subtle. It seems like we're probably getting an Xbox handheld this year. My only thoughts on that really are, if they can hit roughly the price point and performance of something like the Steam Deck, but it plays your Game Pass library, because you can't currently do that on a Steam Deck, yeah, there's probably a market for people who'll pick that up. As long as they can be, like, vaguely comparable with Series S, which they're making sure all their games run on, then yeah, you can make basically the Steam Deck, but it plays Game Pass, which makes sense for them, I think.
Yeah, it does, although I think that the likelihood of it being an equivalent device to the Steam Deck is pretty low. I would expect them to make it a bit inaccessible from a modification point of view.
Oh, I agree with that.
And so, yeah, I mean, I'll definitely be curious to see what they do, because it could open up, you know, I use PC Game Pass, but I'm, you know, if it gives me access to the console library to play it through there at a more affordable price point than buying a console, I might be interested in that. But, you know, we'll just have to see.
Yeah, that's it. If they can hit a similar, like, price and performance target to the Steam Deck, maybe a little above that because the Steam Deck's a couple of years old, have a, we guarantee that any of our first party stuff will run on this, and, you know, they keep their scope in line with, we're already making lower end versions to run on the Series S, there's probably a market there for them on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's it. That's it for this week.
Okie dokie. Well,
yeah.
That's that, Laura.
That is that.
You know what else is something?
What else is something?
Stuff you've done, Laura. We need to know
stuff
what it
I've
is.
Done.
Please.
Well, you can find stuff I've done at Laura K. Buzz, wherever you happen to find people doing stuff. Laura K. Buzz on Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, TikTok, Patreon, that's the one that pays the bills, Blue Sky, Mastodon, wherever you find people, Laura K. Buzz. This week, what have I got coming up this week? I can probably say this. Look for a thing posting this week where I wrote a thing for BAFTA, because it's now been announced that BAFTA have given their special award for this year to the accessibility-focused charity Special Effect. I wrote some stuff for BAFTA about Special Effect in the light of them winning this award. That should be up probably by the time you hear this episode, because they've announced that the awards happen now, so I can probably say, you can read some words, where I interviewed some people to talk about why special effects work is really important and why it's really cool that they're getting recognised by BAFTA. So look forward to that. What about you, Conrad? Where are you on the internet?
Oh, you can find me at Conrad Zimmerman on Instagram and Blue Sky. You can hang out with me on Twitch at twitch.tv/thatconradzimmerman. Been playing still more Balatro, actually, on there. I got that black chip, and yeah, it keeps going. Now I'm one discard down, which really impacts my play of the checkered deck for flushes, which is what I'd been leveraging to, you know, get more difficult. Anyway, not important. Come buy anti-capitalist propaganda and Jimquisition merchandise from me at mercenarycreative.com. And everything that I do online gets supported through Patreon at patreon.com/fistshark. And you know who else has a Patreon? Stephanie Sterling.
That is true. Patreon.com/Jimquisition, which supports this show and the Jimquisition video series and the reviews on the Jimquisition.com, should have a Dragon's Dogma 2 review up, if not before this podcast, not too long after. And then we'll work on getting Rise of Ronin and Peach up as well. I've got wrestling dates, can't remember any of them right now. I know it, well, in Blackpool on June 8th, I will be at Pride of the Ring 3 for PCW. That's the one confirmed. We'll have news on other bookings soon. Thank you all so much for listening and supporting, and we will see you all next week. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.